And you are now tuned into another episode of Intellectually Petty Radio. And tonight we have the distinct honor and privilege to welcome the king himself, Bishop Talbert Swann, to the platform. How you doing, King?
I'm good. How you feeling?
I'm feeling good, man. How's life? How's your family?
Life is good. Family is good. We're in the holiday season, and we're just trying to survive in this pandemic world, this dual pandemic, the pandemic of the health crisis of coronavirus and then the pandemic of white supremacy at the same time. So we're just trying to make it.
That's a good starting point, too, man. And I was going to go into, the backstory as far as what called you to God. But what's the best tool that we have in our arsenal against white supremacy as a people?
Well, the best tool is what God has gifted us with. He's gifted us with resilience. Mm-hmm. He has gifted us with faithfulness. He has gifted us with the creativity and the ingenuity to survive in these tough times. And I think that what people don't understand is I'm convinced that there's really no other people that could have survived what we have, at least in the 400 years that we've sojourned to these yet to be United States of America. When I see how our brothers and sisters of a lighter hue fall apart over such small things. I put up a post not too long ago saying that, when we have white men that are losing their minds and threatening to kill people over Twitter posts, I said, you wouldn't last a day in black skin having to endure what we have to endure on a day-to-day basis. So the resilience that God has blessed us with has helped us to survive all these years.
And I do apologize. I just want to make sure that we had everything on social media, appropriately titled and everything. Yes, I don't want nobody to confuse you with nobody else. Okay, so let's backtrack a little bit. Mm-hmm. At what point do you decide, I want to give my life up to God?
Oh, man. So I grew up in a spiritual family, in a deeply religious spiritual family, from a Pentecostal holiness background. Mm-hmm. It was in my roots from the time I was a child, going to church with my grandmother and my aunt Dot and my mm-hmm. uncle Talbert, whom I'm named after, and others. It was just something that we did, and that, as young people, we gravitated toward it. Some of my siblings, moved away from it, but I was one of the ones that kind of stuck with the church. Mm-hmm. And when I was very young, I would say I must have been about 9 years old when I felt compelled to preach. Mm-hmm. And I had a dream one night. I was in Milwaukee for the summer. And staying out there with my dad, and my grandmother asked me what was going on in the middle of the night. I told her about the dream. Mm-hmm. And she told me that it wasn't the time just yet, but that, God had a call on my life. And about 6 years later, as a young teenager at 15 years old, I preached my first message. It's been my life ever since.
What do you know to talk about at 15?
Nothing. really, what you know to talk about is really kind of regurgitating what you've heard and what you've learned. Mm-hmm. Although I was always inquisitive, always an avid reader. So I kept up with current events and stuff. Even that summer I talked about in Milwaukee, while the other kids were playing, I was going to the corner, grabbing the newspaper out mm-hmm. and reading about Nixon resigning and all of that kind of stuff. So I did have a grasp on current events and history, et cetera. Mm-hmm. But every now and then I would delve into some things that I probably shouldn't have, and my pastor would have to pull me to the side and say, hey, listen, don't preach about things you have no experience with, you know, because you know, older folks really don't want to hear a 15-year-old tell them about their marriage and, you know, and so, you know, you learned as you go along to kind of stay in a certain lane.
Yeah.
In terms of things that you talk about.
I feel you on that one.
Yeah.
Okay. So at what point do you realize, and I don't know if it's a, I'm a nigga moment. Is that a good way to say it? Let me tell you this. Like, I'm sorry, but I'm from Detroit. Like 97% black people my whole life. I didn't really deal with white people at all until college.
Okay.
And I'm riding my bike, and this white guy just randomly yells out the window, "Hey, nigger." I'd never been called a nigger before at that point, until that point in my life. I was so angry. But that was my nigger moment.
Yeah, yeah. You know, I had several of them. Mm-hmm. You know, one of the most poignant moments was when I was going into junior high school, what they call middle school now. My records had not been transferred from elementary school. I was an honor roll student. My assignment should have been in the highest class when I was entering into the ninth grade. And because my records weren't there, they assigned me to the lowest class.
Right.
And during that time, they had no level of sensitivity. They put me in a special ed class. Those classes were held in the basement of the building. I recognized some of the people that were in the class from my neighborhood. And I said to my mother, they got me in a class I do not belong in. Mm-hmm. My mother came up to the school and went off because she knew that the only reason you put my son in that class is because he's black.
Right.
That if you didn't have his record and you didn't know where he belonged, put him somewhere in the middle, but you put him in a special ed class simply because he's black. I realized at that moment that, you know, and I had a consciousness of it, but I realized at that moment that these types of experiences were things that I was going to have to consistently go through over and over again. And from that moment, you know, I was very conscious, you know, of what was happening, being called a nigger, you know, as a young boy, being held at gunpoint by the police when I was on the campus of the University of Massachusetts because I fit the description. And I can just go on and on and on with tons of nigger moments that I had to experience that I think every black man at some point in time is going to experience.
And that's it's just fucked up. There's no way to say that politely. That we can come from anywhere in this country and certain things, and they are all negative to an extent that we share, and we don't even have to talk about it to know.
Oh, exactly. Exactly. It's an automatic connection, you know, just part of American culture that we know that if you're a black man and I'm a black man, there's going to be some level of similarities with what we have experienced.
Facts. Yeah, I absolutely agree. Do you hate white people?
Absolutely not. I hate white supremacy. I hate racism. I hate anti-black bigotry. I love all of God's people. And see, this is where folks get it twisted. Mm. That if you tell the truth about white people, about white supremacy, then what they do is they gaslight and say that you hate white people. And so, you know, my response to them is always, well, you know what? If you think I hate white people because of what I tweet or what I say publicly, then how much more do you think black people think that y'all hate us when you have literally lynched, murdered, raped, enslaved, segregated, brutalized, dehumanized, ostracized, man, mass incarcerated. You've done all of that, and you don't want us to think that you hate black people, but we hate you because we made a tweet that you don't agree with. It's just what I call just plain Caucasity. It's this crazy double and triple standard that white people have, that I can't call you a white supremacist and you support everything about white supremacy, but you turn around and call me a black supremacist because you're mad about a social media post. It's crazy.
Which I've never quite really got a definition for what they're saying with the black supremacist shit or where they get that from. I've seen it before. Oh, and you are, man, your level of petty is you got a gift. Let's put it that way.
Listen, you know, sometimes it's the only way that you stay sane, because you look at this stuff and you're like, are you serious right now? And you know, and so I just have to come back at them in a way that that I can laugh about, but is serious at the same time. So, you know, hey, you know, I'll go there. I'll play the dozens with them. I'll throw in a your mama joke, you know, whatever it is, because they out there mad for some reason. So I'm going to toy with them, you know, while they are.
You give them some notoriety. You're helping them out.
Yeah.
You know. Yeah.
But sometimes it's exposing them. You know, all notoriety is not good. You know.
Yeah.
You know, some folks, like right now, folks are talking about, oh, well, Kyle Rittenhouse is famous. No, he's infamous. There's a difference.
Yeah.
So sometimes I give them notoriety to highlight their ignorance, you know, so that people will see the level of sheer ignorance that we have to deal with.
Kind of remind you, and no, Talib is a lot worse, but like Talib Kweli, like he just sometimes I think his podcast is phenomenal, first and foremost.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah.
But his IG, like he just goes at people that go at him so much of the time that I could see where it could turn some people off. Are you concerned about that?
No, I know my niche. Mm-hmm. I know my audience. I know the reason why people follow me is because I'm being me.
Mm-hmm.
And if I were to try to switch up and try to kind of water down who I am, number one, I wouldn't be authentic to myself. And I wouldn't be real to those who are following me. And I get it that there are some people who are going to be turned off, and that's all right with me. That's mm-hmm. fine with me, because you can go follow somebody else. You know, I was having a debate with one of my fraternity brothers not too long ago, mm-hmm. who was basically saying, you know, that I go too far. With the race baiting. And I told him basically,
a frat brother say that.
Oh, I had a frat brother who said that. And then he got upset because I said, now you're acting like a coon, you know,
ain't no acting, bro. That was,
yeah,
acting.
Yeah. That's coonery. You know,
when you was being polite, he was frat. When
you sit here and tell me I'm race baiting, first of all, that's a white supremacist term. Why are you even using that term? Then he came back and he said, well, you know what? You alluded to that to me before. Now, I don't even know the brother, really, but apparently he was on my Twitter and I must have called him a coon before. He said, the only reason you haven't caught these hands is because you're frat. So I came back and I said, look, bro, number one, I don't know you. Number two, I'm saved, not soft. So ain't nobody catching no hands, bro. No. I think you got the wrong one here, because, you know, I'm not turning cheeks. You know, cry Jesus, not me, because I throw hands.
Shout out to Toby, by the way.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. No, we're not going there.
Does it make you feel like you're wasting your time hearing shit like that, though?
You know, I'm convinced that the reality is we cannot deal with this issue if we are not candid about it, if we're not confrontational about it. If here's the thing. Mm-hmm. I don't believe that America can do all it has done to Black people. And then when Black people talk about it, we have to somehow be polite so we don't hurt the feelings of our oppressor. That's the craziest thing in the world to me. So, you know, you're supposed to sit there cracking the whip on my back, and I'm supposed to say, please, sir, would you please stop doing that, please? No, I don't understand that mentality. Just like the mentality of we're supposed to immediately forgive white supremacists who murder our mothers and kill people in our Black churches and that kind of thing. No, I don't believe in doing that. So we need to be open. We need to be honest about what's going on. And if they can't get with it, to hell with them. Let's move on to somebody who can get with it. But all of this, you know, skirting the issue, mm-hmm. trying to pretend it doesn't exist, mm-hmm. all this step and fetch it coonery that we've seen. We sat there and watched Tim Scott, Republican senator, say America's not a racist country. And everybody went in on him. Uncle Tim. Then Kamala Harris turned around in 24 hours and said the same thing. Democrat vice president of the United States. Then Joe Biden said the same thing. And then James Clyburn said the same thing. And no, we're not going to sit around here and play like America is not racist just for the sake of pleasing our oppressor and using language that is more palatable to their white fragility. No, we need to be open and honest and just, you know, tell it like it is.
So since you brought up Kamala Harris, is there a difference between the Biden and the Trump presidency?
There's a difference. It's like the difference between Coke and Diet Coke. It's like the difference between, you know, sweet and low and equal. You know, it's the same thing, with a different taste to it. And I say that because anytime you can, get into office on the backs of Black people. When Biden was elected, he said to the Black community, I have your back. And I said, there's a difference between having our backs and riding our backs. He rode our backs into the White House.
That he did.
But he has not had our backs since he's been there. He got into the White House and immediately he gave gifts to the LGBTQ community. I'm signing an executive order to protect you. Facts. He gave gifts. I'm giving a $5 billion law to protect Asian Americans and Pacific Islanders because there was an increase in hate crimes. There was a total of 262 hate crimes against them during that calendar year. Conversely, there was over 3,000 hate crimes against Black people that same year. So how do you say, 200 hate crimes against you, get you a $5 billion piece of legislation, and yet and still we face hate crimes at a higher clip than everybody else? We can't get an anti-lynching bill. We can't get police reform passed. They're trying to suppress our votes. We can't get the Voting Rights Act that was neutered in 2013. We can't get that fixed. They won't even have a conversation about reparations. No. You know, he goes all the way to Tulsa to commemorate the 100th year of the Tulsa massacre, and the surviving person that's there, do you think she got any reparations? Somebody gave her a pair of sneakers, but they don't even want to talk about reparations. So my thing is, yeah, what is the difference between them and Trump? Is that Trump is an in-your-face, overt racist that plays to his racist base because that's who supports him. Biden is a kinder, gentler kind of racist. Yes. But at the end of the day, Black folks are still neglected, left out, ostracized, dumped, and dismissed. And the only thing we've gotten so far out of this administration is recognition of Juneteenth and Hip Hop Recognition Month. I mean, come on.
Wait a minute, they got a Hip Hop Month? I didn't know that.
Yeah, they got a Hip Hop Recognition Month.
Wow.
Okay. But no police reform, but no voting rights.
No
reparations, you know, but we got Hip Hop Recognition Month.
I mean, I love hip hop as much as the next guy, but you know.
Right. and then after all of that, they're going to have the caucasity to tell us, you know what? You got to keep us in office in 2022 in these midterms. We got to keep the Senate. If you Negroes are going to get anything, you got to make sure the Democrats have the House and the Senate. And I know we haven't given you anything yet. We'll give it to you after the next election. This is what they keep doing, kicking the can down the road. When Trump got in 16, they told us in 2018, if you give us the House, we'll do something for you. Ain't do nothing. 2020, haven't done anything.
Nothing.
But keep voting for us. Put us back in 2022, because the alternative is you get the Republicans. So basically, they're using on us the same scare tactics that Republicans use on racist white folks. They tell racist white folks, if Democrats get in, you know, the niggers are going to move in your neighborhood.
Yep.
You know, the immigrants are going to take all your jobs.
Yeah.
You know, they use those scare tactics. And then Democrats use the scare tactics on Black people. If Republicans get in, you know, they're going to do this to you. You know, the police are going to murder you more if they get in. They're going to take away your checks, you know, all that. So it's the same thing. Both parties, you know, it's two wings to the same bird, using the same scare tactics against their own base to make sure that they get in office.
I mean, but, you know, we got the opportunity to start our own shit. We just don't.
Oh, absolutely. You know, we continue to talk about what would happen if we started another party. But we never do that. It's like we're ingrained in this duopoly, in this two-party system. And my thing is, if we're going to play in the two-party system, then we should not be beholden to any one party. We should not be 90% in the Democrat base, because then they take us for granted, because they're banking on, you know what, they're gonna vote for us anyway, because the alternative is the Republicans. They're not gonna go with them, and so they neglect us, and so when we start withholding votes from certain races, if we decide we're gonna go with the other party in certain races, and you know, do the bait and switch so they don't know which way we're coming, then we make both parties compete.
Exactly,
you know, for our support.
Yeah, I would agree with that. You know, it's either we're gonna have to unite our votes or our money.
Yeah,
ain't much of a gray area in this country on that. You know, what is slaveholder Christianity?
Well, slaveholder Christianity, first of all, there's this misconception and ahistorical perspective about Christianity being a quote unquote white man's religion. Mm-hmm. And I get where that came from, because Christianity was perverted in Europe by the Catholic Church, by Protestants in America, and they whitenized Christianity, but Christianity at its roots is African. Mm-hmm. It's the oldest Christian church in the world is the Ethiopian Coptic Church. It's something that started in the cradle of Africa. And
church is incredible, by the way, man.
Absolutely.
That's
absolutely
the one they built in the ground, right? Like the goodness. Yes.
And
sorry to interrupt.
But no problem. And so slaveholder Christianity is a whiteanized version of Christianity that was promulgated to prop up white supremacy, mm-hmm. To make enslaved black people better tools of service. It was the depiction of Jesus, a man born in Northeast Africa, because the reality is what they now call the Middle East was nothing but Northeast Africa. The only thing that separates the so-called Middle East from Northeast Africa is a man-made waterway called the Suez Canal, which wasn't even built until the 1850s. Mm-hmm. Parts of the Middle East sits on the same tectonic plate as Africa. So Christ born in Northeast Africa, now they're depicting him as a blonde-haired, blue-eyed, white European, because in order to prop up white supremacy, you can't have deity looking like the people that you oppress. So deity has to look like you, so that not only do they see deity as white, they see you in the image of deity and themselves in a different light. And so whitenized Christianity was taught to our ancestors to make them tools of better service. They cherry picked certain scriptures, slaves, be obedient to your master. Those types of things. They had black preachers go to plantations to preach that they be subservient to their masters. That's how Nat Turner started out. Other plantations would pay his owner for him to come to their plantation and preach their slaves into submissiveness until Nat got an epiphany that this ain't how it's supposed to be, and then led a slave revolt. And so whitenized slaveholder Christianity is that Christianity that makes white folks think they have a manifest destiny, that they were justified in committing genocide against Native Americans and stealing their lands, enslaving black people, and keeping them in chattel slavery for 236 years, and the continued brutalization of their ancestors. They could, in good conscience, lynch a black man on Saturday night, cut off his genitals, take his body parts home, roast marshmallows around his body with their children, take pictures, and then go praise white Jesus on Sunday morning. That's slaveholder Christianity, and the child of slaveholder Christianity is modern day white evangelical Christianity.
So why hasn't most black churches converted to your way of thinking?
You know, they're still stuck in a framework of a Christianity that compels them to be submissive and docile in the face of white tyranny, and to look for a prize once they die. They want the pie in the sky. But I tell folks, I don't just want pie in the sky. I want steak by the lake, you know, while I'm here.
It would be nice.
Absolutely. And they have not converted from that. And I tell people all of the time, if your pastor and your church does not preach a liberation theology, the first message that Christ preached, found in Luke 4:18, he says, "The Spirit of the Lord is upon me, for he has anointed me to preach good tidings to the poor. He sent me to the brokenhearted, to set at liberty those that are captive," which was a direct reference to those who were wrongfully imprisoned in a white supremacist Roman colonized Israel. So he sent me to set at liberty those that are captive, to set free those that are bruised and oppressed. So Jesus says, I came for the poor, for the sick, for the wrongfully imprisoned, and for the oppressed. That's his first message. And then he spent his life ministering to on behalf of those demographics. Then white folks come along and say social justice is antithetical to Christianity. What the hell do you mean? What Bible are you reading? Because you cannot read the same Bible that I read and read the words of Christ and come to any reasonable conclusion that social justice is antithetical to Christianity, but it is the backbone of Christianity. And black preachers who have not embraced a liberation theology, they are agents of the same white supremacist slaveholder Christianity as their white evangelical brothers and sisters.
I'll say that, and I'll say one other thing is that we have, as a people, shown a pattern of basically leaving our leaders out dry.
Yeah.
They die broke. Mm-hmm. Their wives struggle. Mm-hmm. We don't make leadership glamorous enough.
Well, you know, unfortunately, people often only commit to a movement to the extent in which it affects them.
Yeah.
30 years of activism, I've seen the cycle over and over again. And I've had to check people over and over again. Mm-hmm. I remember when a young man's son was killed, mm-hmm. And which kind of thrust him into the movement. And he wondered, well, where is this one? Where is that? Where are the black preachers? Where are the, you know, and I understood his passion, his concern.
All right.
And I had to pull him to the side. I said, where were you
before when
it was other people's children being killed or brutalized or discriminated against? They were asking the same questions. And where were you? See, when it directly affects us, we're all in.
Yeah.
When it doesn't affect us, you know, we opt out.
Yeah.
You know, of the movement. And people will support a leader as long as he is speaking to their cause. But when the block gets too hot, they will leave him out to dry. The reality of our history is at the time of MLK's death, the polling that was out during that time, he had his lowest polling numbers among black folk and white folks, you know, during that time. Malcolm died broke. Martin died broke. And though people, you know, call out their names today, I often say, yeah, but if you had lived during their times, you wouldn't support them any more than you support me or Dr. Freddie Haynes or any number of people who are out here on these streets fighting for you every single day.
Yeah. You know, I don't know if you're familiar with Grandmaster Jay.
Yes.
Okay. Friend of the show. Mm-hmm. Definitely. But what I've noticed also, and he's talked about this too. Matter of fact, he put a meme up that Kyle Rittenhouse raised $2 million and got off. He's raised a couple hundred thousand dollars and they still dragging his ass through court. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And even if you don't like that cat, you could hate his guts. You got to respect the movement that the man put together.
Mm-hmm.
And we should make a point, just in my 2 cents, to make sure that this man is funded and sees this through and gets out of this shit.
But you know what? There's a lot of black people who are speaking against the brother.
Yes.
And my thing is, you know what? In this white supremacist system, hey, man, you may have your differences with the brother, but let him live.
Yes.
And you're absolutely right. These white folks didn't care whether Kyle Rittenhouse was innocent or guilty.
Not at all.
All they knew is this is a young white boy who went to a Black Lives Matter march, and anybody who was marching for Black Lives deserves to be shot. So we're going to support him. Absolutely. And it was a white evangelical Christian crowdfunding site that they used to raise $2 million for this boy. And now that he has gotten off, they are bringing him on every network, television show, podcast, and trying to make a celebrity out of this guy who murdered two people. And by contrast, you're right. When our folks get into trouble, we don't have this network that's going to raise them $2 million, that's going to make sure that their legal bills are paid, that's going to stand by their side. You know, we will stand with the families of victims, but oftentimes we won't stand by our leaders who are being victimized.
And we got to stop with the, and they're going to kill me for this one. Cause I was talking to my brother who is currently locked up just today. And we were talking about super drug dealers. I'm not going to say no particular names, but how like everybody's free this person and buying all a merch and doing whatever they can financially. And we really should be looking at these individuals as Hitlers to our community. They have helped genocide amongst their own people. And we celebrate them.
Yeah. You know, that reminds me of, I've seen so much criticism through the years of people who will talk about preachers like me. And they don't have to know my personal circumstance, but they take a shot in the dark.
Right.
Okay, that's why you're rich and people in your congregation are poor and yada yada. I'm like, you don't know my financial circumstance, nor do you know how I earn my living. You're making assumptions. But my thing is this: they will castigate a preacher for driving a Mercedes.
Facts.
And then celebrate the drug dealer who drives a more expensive Mercedes. And I'm saying to myself, wait a minute. So I'm here preaching a message of liberation, empowering and inspiring people. I've got young folks who've come through my church who I've seen years later and said, Bishop Swan, I'm doing this, that, and the other. And I was inspired to do this when I went through your youth program. And I just want to thank you. And, you know, I get this all of the time who tell us how they were inspired to do the things that they're doing and gone off and been successful in life. And so I'm here running an operation that is mentoring our young people, that is serving our seniors, you know, that is serving the community. But if I drive a Benz, I'm the devil. But if the drug dealer who is selling poison to your children, that's got your uncle strung out and not taking care of his kids, that's got your cousin overdosing and dying, you celebrating that man. Oh, that's dope. Oh, that cost this, that cost that. It's like our priorities are completely, you know, screwed up. Is that we celebrate, you know, the profane instead of celebrating the profound. And it's something that we've got to get away from. We've seen that flip in a generation. I mean, you even look at the names of our singing groups. Back in the day, they had names like the Supremes, the Miracles, the Marvelettes. Now we got Ludacris and we got, you know, and there's no aspersion.
Luda's dope though, man.
Well, the brother Luda is dope. I'm just saying, you know, it's like we have this celebration of whatever is negative.
Yeah.
And I don't understand that, because that is definitely not the legacy that our ancestors left for us.
Okay, but let me ask you this. Is there ever too much for a pastor? Like, what's the old boy? They found 600 stacks in his walls, allegedly.
Well, that's
like, come on, bro.
He's a white evangelical.
But we're not going to act like it's some brothers. We ain't got no brothers doing the same shit on a smaller scale.
We got some brothers doing some stuff out there. But this is Joel Osteen, who's got the largest church in America.
What do you need 600 grand in the wall for, though, bro? Legally put it in the bank.
Well, no. Somebody stole it. Somebody jacked the people who were taking the offering and stole the money. They reported that they stole, and apparently the person who stole the money stashed it in the wall. And for whatever reason, that's what they're trying to figure out, why they never went back to get it. So you had this contractors there who removed the toilet and found the money in the wall, but that's money that had been stolen from the church, you know, years ago.
That church would have never, they would have never heard about that 600 stacks.
That's what's surprising is that.
The Lord would have blessed me and my family that day.
Let me put it like this. This is my own theory. My own theory is there was $1 million in that wall. They just heard about 600,000.
I could go for that. I just can't see the whole thing. No, bro.
Yeah.
Wow. I didn't know that was the whole story, though.
Right.
Well, right. Allegedly.
But there's a line you have to. I think there's something to be said for modesty. Mm-hmm. You know, as a preacher, there's something to be said for to ensure that. That the perception is wholesome, but then at the same time, if I wasn't a preacher, if I'm a preacher, and my church has a $25 million budget, what is reasonable for me? Because if I was a business owner of a secular business that had a $25 million budget, people wouldn't have a problem with me living in a nice house and driving a nice car and having a little bling.
That's not a fair comparison, though.
And all of that. They wouldn't have a problem with that.
But I don't think that's not a fair comparison. Only because morality is an expectation
But here's the thing. Let me push back on that, because that makes the assumption that what he has was gotten by ill-gotten gains or immoral behavior. We can't make that assumption. You know what salary that the church places on him is reasonable. And then the other thing that people have to realize is a lot of times pastors have other streams of income that don't even come from their churches. You know, they speak, they do speaking engagements, they write books, they do a number of consulting things. So they're doing all kinds of other things that are bringing in money, but people make, I remember one time, I had guys when I was just started out pastoring, I wasn't even taking a salary. I was putting more money in the church than was ever coming out of the church. And I was working, I was bivocational. So I was working a full-time job and I had just bought a new car. And so I was paying these guys to paint the small building that I had purchased. And I hear the guy out there talking, hey, look, see, that's what I'm talking about. And the preacher got the new car. And I know people in the church poor, yada, 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 yada. And I'm like, nigga, please. I bought that car. With mama, the church ain't had nothing to do with that car. Church can't even, at that point, the church couldn't even afford to give me no money. But people jump to those conclusions about preachers that somehow they're fleecing the flock. And I'm not saying that there aren't some that do that.
Right.
I just think it's unfair to paint them all with the same brush.
I mean, it's contextual. Like if you pulling up to, I don't know if you've ever been to Detroit, but like one of the, say Davison and Linwood, bad area. And you got a church there and you in a Rolls Royce. It looks a lot different than if you out in the burbs and got a church and you got a Rolls Royce.
But then at the same time, if he rode up on a bike, then people would mock him and say, what kind of God are you serving that you can't even afford a car? Or if he rode up in a beater, they would have something to say about that. So where do you kind of draw the line?
Yeah. And that's, I think you know, people don't got to read the room.
Yeah, absolutely.
You got to do a better job. You know, a lot of people.
And I get your point. I remember I was with a friend of mine and we went down to Morehouse and we were meeting with the United Way about some potential funding. And he's a wealthy guy. He has a home in Atlanta. And he had rented a car for us to go to Morehouse. When we got done with our meeting, One of his guys came around with his Rolls Royce, and I said, "Man, why weren't we riding in the Rolls Royce?" He said, "Well, man, we can't go and ask folk for money and pull up in a Rolls Royce. So you gotta read the room."
Yeah,
I get the point.
Yeah, that's pretty dope, though, man. When's the last time you cried?
Oh man, probably a couple of days ago. You know, we lost a dear friend of ours. Mm-hmm. Her daughter, you know, passed away suddenly, and this has been a difficult season. You know, I've been to 3 funerals in the last week. I literally just got home today from one in Buffalo. I preached one at my church on Wednesday for a member of our congregation. I went to one on Monday as mm-hmm. well. And when I got to Buffalo, found out another dear friend, preacher friend, died of COVID as well. And this is a rough season. You know, mm-hmm. I know people, there are differing opinions around this whole issue. And, you know, you got your people who are anti-vax and some are pro-vax. And, you know, my thing is live and let live. If you don't want to get it, don't get it. Don't condemn the people that do. And if you do get it, don't condemn the people that don't. But at the end of the day, we're in the middle of a serious public health crisis that is very real. And, you know, my main problem is with people who try to downplay it and pretend that it's not what it is, because I have buried too many people, family members, church members. I've preached too many funerals. I've seen the suffering firsthand. My wife had it. My mother had it. My sister had it. I buried my mother-in-law. I buried my brother-in-law. And so, you know, these are difficult, you know, times. And so every now and then you kind of get overwhelmed by seeing death and sickness and all of that. And sometimes it'll drive you to tears.
You don't ever get angry at God?
All the time. You know, and I always tell people that you have a right to question God. You have a right to.
You're the first pastor I've ever heard say that, because I've been doing that shit my whole life. And that's the reason I don't really go to church all that much, is because I have questions and they get offended.
But God expects that. I preached a message about a week ago entitled "Come and Talk to Me." And it's from a verse of scripture where it says, "Come, let us reason together." God is having a debate in the middle of the debate with Israel. He says, "Wait, come, let us reason together." He's inviting them into a conversation. Even though I'm omniscient, omnipresent, mm-hmm. I respect you enough to let you question me, to let you have your questions, and for me to give you answers. And yes, you have a right to question God. Wait a minute, God, you said this in your word. But it don't seem like that. You know, you have a right to ask why, when, how. I don't think God expects for us to just be robots, you know, that have absolutely no questions about anything. And in my reading of scripture, even in the mm-hmm. early church, it said that the disciples searched the scripture daily, meaning that when they heard the apostles preaching, mm-hmm. they didn't just take them at their word. They went and searched and studied the scripture themselves to say, I want to see if Paul knew what he was talking about at Sunday service.
Right.
And I want people to do that. You know, don't just take my word for it to see if I'm accurate in what I preach to you. Do your own research. Do your own study. And if you have a conflict with what I've said, let's have a conversation about it.
Now, say the book of Job for me, and I'm no scholar by any stretch, but that's like one of the pettiest things in the Bible that I've read. And it just always boggles me how This is one of the questions I would have, I guess, you know, when it's my time. And if I'm honored enough to meet God and they say, yeah, you got a couple questions. I'm asking about the book of Job. Why y'all gambling on this man's life? Mm-hmm. Like y'all could have went, he could have made your point without killing this man's wife and kids and making him broke. Cause you can get another wife and kids, but you can't replace them. And to me, like to say that you can replace I guess, you know, giving him what they call more abundance and he was richer and had, mm-hmm. A better looking wife. But she the one that was with you on the come up. Mm-hmm. She the one that seen the struggle before she died. You feel what I'm saying? So you can't replace her because. So I'm just angry at why he would allow the devil to do all of that shit.
So I believe the late O.T. Jones Jr. was a mentor of mine, and he said, mm-hmm. when you read the Bible, study the stories, because you will find yourself, your situation of others in the stories that don't necessarily take all the stories literal, because there's a lesson to be learned within the story. And so when we look at Job, I think the lesson to be learned is that life deals sometimes great tragedy. Life will deal to us some crushing circumstances that we feel like we cannot get through. Because if you just imagine losing your wife and all your children, man. Or losing all your children and your wife not having confidence and walk away from you and your friends judging you and all of that. Just imagine that level of trauma and tragedy. And the moral to it is, yes, even though he went through that trauma and tragedy, that he still found a level of peace on the other side of it. And then you can juxtapose that story against anything that you might be going through in life. Mm-hmm. To say, as traumatic as this is, as rough as this is, I'm going to get through this. And when I get through this, the healing will come from the hurt, and I'll be able to smile again at some point in life. So I think there's a greater story within the context of what's written in the Bible that we're mm-hmm. supposed to pull from.
Mm-hmm. And I know we didn't get with a couple minutes. Just a couple questions, I guess. What's the closest you come to quitting being a pastor?
Woo! I can think of several times. That I said, you know what? I can just get this up. Somebody else can come pastor this church. You hard-headed Negroes, you ungrateful. I mean, there are times where you feel like, listen, as much as I give and sacrifice and get taken for granted and neglected and disrespected, y'all not paying me enough. You ain't giving me enough to continue. I'm educated. You know, I got 5 earned degrees. Okay. I can go get a job in the secular world and just sit on 6 figures and chill and go travel and not deal with the headaches of dealing with Black folk and their problems and all of that.
And so, then white folks would actually just pay you to shut up.
Yeah. They probably would. They would. But there have been several times throughout my career as a pastor mm-hmm. that I, you know, I have seriously contemplated, you know what, let me just go on back into the corporate world and get this up and call it a day. But, you know, there's this compelling, this loyalty to what I feel like is a call on my life mm-hmm. To remain faithful and to just kind of make my way through it. And I think at the end of the day, I made the right choice that I think someone said this before. They said, you know that you are doing the thing that you're supposed to do when you're able to make a living doing something that you would do for free anyway.
Hmm. I wouldn't be no pastor for 30 years for free though, bro.
Yeah, well,
yeah, I had to go get a job at the plant or something.
but the point is, if I had to work at the plant,
mm-hmm.
would I still be in ministry? Absolutely.
Really?
Yeah.
Man, that's dedication, bro.
Yeah.
30 years, man. Whew, Lord. If people want to get in touch with you, they want to donate, whatever, how they go about doing that?
Well, I'm on all social media. It's at Talbert Swan, T-A-L-B-E-R-T-S-W-A-N. My church website is 413hope.org. And any way you want to donate, all of that information is there. And we appreciate any level of support.
I appreciate the honesty, too, man. It's not too often you get to speak to, I won't say an honest pastor, but a pastor that is so open.
Yeah, you know, I think that that we've got to be candid and open and transparent with each other, because through your life, through my life, people can see themselves. They can see their situations, and they can understand that what we were able to get through, that they can as well. So I'm always willing to share.
I don't know about me, but they'll definitely get some inspiration from you, King. On that note, man, if you ever need anything, bro, please don't hesitate to say what you need. I got you, bro. This has been an honor and a privilege, and I thoroughly enjoyed the conversation, man. I just want to thank you, man. Oh, and I need to tell you too, man, if nobody's told you today, I'm proud of you, bro.
Oh, man, I appreciate that. Thank you so much. I appreciate the invitation and the conversation.
No doubt, man. Again, anybody out there, don't forget to hit the like button and subscribe, man. This is My Skin Is My Sin presents another episode of Intellectually Petty Radio. Peace. You have a good one, King.
All right, you too.